All right, welcome to another episode of That's So Cincinnati. Jason Williams, Sherry Coolidge, Silent Phil. We're back. After we took a week off last week, logistically, it just didn't work. I know I got in some emails. Hey, where's the podcast? Here it is. We're back. Happy to be back. Sherry, how are you?
Oh, it's so good to talk to you. It has been a while. I believe the last Coolidge that you spoke to was one Alexander Coolidge.
It was. And that was actually the last time I talked to him as well when we recorded that, two weeks ago. And my gosh, it seems like 2 years ago because so much has happened.
That is 100% true. Do I need to worry about being replaced real quick?
By Alexander?
Yes.
I don't know. He was great. He got us Jose Salazar, the restaurateur and chef. And, really had a great chat with him. And by the way, if you did not, for our listeners, if you did not hear that episode, some great insight on Over the Rhine. And that interview was done before even what's, you know, happened since then and Over the Rhine. So go back and check that out a couple weeks ago. I don't think you have anything to worry about, Sherry.
Okay, thank you.
Oh, where do we even start today?
Well, our guest today, you know, is, since this did happen, you know, the world has changed. We saw the death of George Floyd in Minneapolis, and, you know, a movement that has started as a result of that, and including in Cincinnati. We have seen a lot of protests, and so we're going to have a very serious conversation about that today with Assistant Police Chief Paul Neudigate, who I think a lot of people might have seen, because this is very widely circulated video taken by one of our Inquirer co-workers, Madeline Mitchell, where he engaged with the protesters in front of City Hall and really had a conversation with them. And so we, instead of just, I think, talking about everything that has happened, we want to further the conversation and talk about where the city's going. And so that's going to be, you know, our special guest today.
Really looking forward to having Assistant Chief Neudigate. You know, when you hear his name, and certainly the world that we live in, and in politics and government, but every time I hear his name, it is always said in such high regard. And there's so much respect for him. And I know just in I've been at the Inquirer for 8 years, and every time I've heard his name brought up, it's said with so much respect. And so I'm really looking forward to having him on.
And, you know, we had this discussion. I think what we always do, like, this is very behind the scenes look at what we do. We did have a conversation about having the chief on, and we've had the chief before, and we like to get to know our leaders some in these conversations too. It's not necessarily always just about what's the news right now. We like to have somebody who is in the news, but get to know them a little bit better. And so that's kind of how that video clip, I thought that he would be a really good interview, but, you know, definitely look for a lot of commentary. The chief has been out there. He kneeled in front of District 1 with the protesters, very powerful moment. And so, you know, all of our coverage is very much, you know, involving the police chief has, you know, been at the forefront and really talking about all this. So he's definitely involved in our coverage, but we just went a little bit different direction today, I think.
Yeah, and thanks to Chief Isaac for he allowed us to have Assistant Chief Neudigate to join us today, and I'm glad you brought up Chief Isaac. I talked to Mayor Cranley yesterday and asked him about the job that Chief Isaac's done through this, and Cranley's quote was superhero status, and couldn't say enough good things about him, and so yeah, looking forward to having Assistant Chief Neudigate talk more about the response from the police to the protests and the engagement. You know, we're going to talk to him about the video and in which, you know, he stepped over the barrier and really engaged with protesters and shared his phone number. And wow, like, yeah, I think this is going to be really, really interesting to talk with him about that. Meanwhile, you know, so much of that has dominated the news but there's so many other things going on. One of which, Sherry, later today, or as we record this on Wednesday, on Thursday, the city's budget is coming out, and it's, we all know that we've talked so much and written so much about, this is such a unique budget season with the pandemic. Oh yeah, the pandemic, by the way, is that, that's still going on.
Yeah.
And how that's affected budgets and governments, big and small, across the country, and certainly has affected Cincinnati. What should we expect from this budget? What's going to be affected? What's not going to be affected? Give us some perspective. No one knows this better than you, Sherry.
Well, there's been a lot of doomsday predictions, I have to say. And every year there's some doomsday predictions. And if you do it every year, you get a little bit like, it's not going to be like that. But this year is, thanks to the coronavirus, you know, with so many people being out of work, I think a million people statewide, and just the shuttering of businesses for 6 weeks or more, really, it hurt the budget because, you know, it's like two-thirds comes from earnings tax.
Yep.
And it just, that has been devastating to the budget. And that number has bounced around. They're talking, as of Monday, the deficit was $73.4 million out of $416 million for the operating budget. It's just an astronomical number. And, you know, I know that number has been very scary. The city did have to furlough workers. The mayor, actually, when he was talking about it in the press conference, was crying. It was so difficult. He was so upset of having to do that. I have to say, though, the city does have a line of credit, and I guess if there was ever a time to use it, this is now. I have heard that they are going to dip into, the city has approval to borrow $50 million to kind of get us through this, up to $50 million, and I think they're going to use some of that money, so the cuts aren't as dire. But I have heard across the board, everybody's getting cut. Everybody. Yep. Police, fire. But it is not the doomsday scenario that, you know, any good city manager does warn the council ahead of time. We had heard there could be actual layoffs of police and firefighters. And this was a year where I was like, that's not a political statement. I thought that it really could happen, and was thinking about, you know, what those scenarios would look like. This was, you know, before the protests that we saw, and the idea that we would even have, you know, fewer police officers who have been the face of these protests, and like how they're reacting. But the firefighters are very much a part of these strike teams, and they're to prevent arson. You know, these first responders are incredibly important. And so I don't think we're going to have any layoffs. If I'm wrong, Jason, you yell at me next week and say, what are you doing?
Well, I mean, I've talked to John Cranley and PG Sittenfeld, and they both have said there will be, I mean, they couldn't have been more clear that there will be no layoffs of police officers and firefighters, those frontline folks. Now, Cranley's did say that there would be cuts in the police department and across all departments, but he wouldn't go into details about that when I asked him. But I took that as, you know, some other non-police, you know, administrators. So much, obviously, Sherry, you guys have detailed the budget, and there's a lot of staffing and a lot of equipment and a lot that goes into a police department besides just the police officers themselves.
We have heard, you know, really a mantra right now is defund the police. And that's really a very buzzy catchphrase. And that is not a phrase that anyone in our city government is using, but they do talk about the idea of shifting some things, which is really what defund the police means. Shifting resources into things that mean we don't need to use the police as much. And so I am expecting to see, you know, Greg Lansman's eviction prevention program is more important than ever right now. I think we're going to see, you know, attention paid to some of these social service issues, which council always does try to do. This is a very Democratic council. These are ideals that are important to them. And I think you're going to see like a renewed, you know, spotlight put on some of these things that can help the mental health aspect of things, catch these safety net things. Well, I think we're going to see in the budget, and I if the health department budget is cut, I will be shocked. I do think that's something that's going to be spared and bolstered. Public health is very important in Cincinnati. We have this whole system of health clinics, and that's part of who this city is. And not all cities run public health clinics, but this is, it's been able to, you know, really be that safety net in Cincinnati where our elected officials can, you know, really control the spending of it and make sure that exists. And so I think that we're going to see the health budget bolstered some there. And I think the unveiling's at a health clinic is like my biggest clue there. So we'll be looking at that budget. That's pretty important.
And now on to some of the pet projects and programs. Where are some of those things going to land? The streetcar, some social service programs, funding of, you know, the Port Authority. That's not necessarily a pet thing, but
I think that those kind of things,
the non-basic government.
Exactly. Not the basic services. Those are going to just basically get across the board cuts, and everyone's just going to have to deal with those. I think, you know, there are going to be two public hearings next week on Tuesday and Thursday.
Now, hang on a sec, Sherry. When you say across the board cuts, do you mean they'll be cut completely, or
everyone's going to have to take some sort of cut. But I'm not expecting the zeroing out of anything, not even the most controversial things, like some for closing the health gap over the years. There's always arguments about funding that. I think that
They will get funded. It sounds to me like, yeah.
So
in some form or fashion, they'll receive funding. The Port Authority will receive the funding. Yeah. Yeah. Keep going. Sorry.
Oh, no, that's fine. So those are like our social services, and, you know, let's not call it pet projects, but let's call them, you know, the kind of things that some council members believe in more than others, some of them. And it's always a balance of who's, you know, social service agency. They always have to come to kind of like, you know, an agreement on things. That's where all the backroom talks kind of happen about these things. But if we're going to talk about the streetcar, and we're going to, and I'm going to try and not make that the main focus of things.
Yeah.
When what really matters to citizens is basic services, but it cannot be ignored. Last year, they had to take money. The streetcar cost $5 million a year to run. It just does. It shut down now for public health reasons. It's a huge controversy in itself. We'll not talk about that right now. But, you know, the idea that it is shut down, it was struggling before the pandemic to meet, you know, its metrics. No one is saying that it hasn't done what a lot of people want it to do, which is, you know, spur this economic growth. But there are very serious metrics in its budget. It has to have this much advertising. It has to have, you know, this much in fares to make that budget work. And it fell short last year in what obviously was a much better year than this year. There's going to be a shortfall. And the question is, how much money do they want to take out of the operating budget to put in the streetcar budget? Because every dollar not in the operating budget is money that's not going to basic services, that's not going to these social service agencies. And so we're going to see the mayor and the city manager unveil a budget, right, with just a lot of equal cuts in it. But council's going to have to make some difficult decisions. That's their job. So there's no way to avoid this conversation.
I think what you'll see, no, you're exactly right, Sherry. I think what you'll see out of the city manager and the mayor's budget proposal is you're not going to see that general, you're not going to see the funding for the streetcar. You're not going to see it. You're going to see a very, very small amount of money in there just to keep it going as is right now, because there has to be some money put into it to keep, I guess, maintaining the line and, you know, keep the thing going, running empty, I guess, as it's been now for what, a couple months?
Yes.
And so you're right. Council's going to have to make some tough decisions. And this is, council's going to be in a position here where, what are they going to do? Are they going to kind of just sort of go along with this budget proposal from the administration and be like, okay, we'll just kind of keep it shut down indefinitely under the health, pandemic? Or are they going to have to make a decision to vote to borrow money to keep it going, for another year? Obviously, the council has already approved the city can borrow up to what, $50 million. And so I do think for other things, you're going to see some of that $50 million dipped into, not all of it. Is the council going to be in a position where they're going to have to say, if we really want to keep this going, this is going to put those mayoral candidates, future mayoral candidates, David Mann, P.G. Sittenfeld, I believe, on the spot to make a decision here, because obviously the streetcar, whether we like it or not, plays into elections.
Well, I have to say, it's occurring to me now that since we last talked, the mayor's race has changed. David Mann did announce during this time that he would be running for mayor, and so we predicted the start of this mayor's race much sooner than this, and I think that would have been a very true statement had we not had the coronavirus pandemic, and then the reaction to George Floyd's death. But this budget, I think, now is going to be, these are your mayoral candidates, and these are their priorities. There's no way that, it can't be seen with that prism, in which P.G. Sittenfeld, to be fair, has not announced. I know someone's going to 100% text me and say,
open secret.
Announced. Open secret. And so this will be, I think, really the opening of that race and priorities.
600,000 reasons why he is running for mayor, as he's raised over $600,000 for his not yet announced campaign. But yeah, you're right. And both of those candidates, David Mann, councilman currently, and P.G. Sittenfeld, back going all the way back to 2013, were critical votes to keep, when it was do or die on the streetcar, they were critical votes to do it. And so it'll be interesting to see how they both play this. And I do know that David Mann has spoken to over the Ryan Community Council and said that it's a non-starter to completely permanently shut it down. I do know that I wrote a column a month ago. I don't even, all these days and weeks and months are just running together. Was it maybe a month ago where I had asked all the members of Congress in our area whether they would be willing to help City Hall get out of the FTA, the federal government grants that were paid into the streetcar. And Congressman Winstrup and Chabot both said they were open to that discussion. Those have not gone anywhere. Those have been explored that I know of, that has been discussed and explored, but it's been realized that it's probably not going to be a feasible thing to do. So where do we go from here on the streetcar? And I think in the context of when we talk about the streetcar right now, is you talk about it in what's going to be, at what expense is what's going to be cut at that expense? If they want to keep the streetcar going, then what's the other side of that? Who will lose their job in what department, and what other cuts in other departments at the expense of the streetcar? And that to me is really the argument here, is the context of the streetcar. And certainly we've talked about it ad nauseum, and the political football that it is and all that. But this is really, I think, where the rubber has met the road on the streetcar in terms of the budget and the budget challenge that it presents, is we're really seeing that now. Sorry, that was a very long.
No, I understand. Yeah. So, all right. So should we stop guessing, and we'll just next week, we will know how right we were and how wrong we were.
Yeah. As probably many folks are listening to this on a Thursday morning. That comes out. The budget comes out, or the budget proposal from the mayor comes out later today. And there'll be some public hearings on that coming up. I believe that next week, Sherry.
Tuesday and Thursday at the convention center. Like, we don't have a lot of details yet. There's going to be ways to call in, perhaps Zoom in. The city hall, because of safety reasons, has been closed to the public for several weeks now. But everyone does agree that there has to be a mechanism for the public to have their say on the budget. In fact, with this much shorter process on top of it, it's all the more important that these hearings happen in some fashion.
And in normal years, Sherry, these meetings would have already been, they would have already taken place, what, a month or?
Oh, absolutely. And we would have been fighting about this for weeks, I know.
Yeah, right. Anyway, good stuff. We'll definitely be checking out your coverage on the city budget and all the things that are so much.
Oh, I feel like we'll have a column or two by the next time.
Perhaps. Perhaps. Let's shift gears and bring in our special guest today, Assistant Chief Paul Newdegate. All right, special guest time on the That's So Cincinnati podcast. A real honor and pleased to welcome in Cincinnati Police Assistant Chief Paul Newdegate, head of the Patrol Bureau for the Police Department. Assistant Chief Newdegate, thanks for joining us today.
You're welcome, Jason. Thank you for having me.
Wow. You made headlines, for stepping out and joining and engaging in a dialogue with the protesters last week. And we just wanted to ask you right out of the gate, like, what really made you take that step to go and have that conversation and start that conversation?
Well, I think, our police department, and, we'd like to think that we have drastically changed who we are from 2001 to present. And all along, I think we were looking for that opportunity for dialogue. It just did not exist those first few days, that Friday, Saturday, Sunday. You could tell that, on the other side of the barricades, on the other side of the shields, that they were not ready for that. And, they kind of drive our responses. But what happened that day is, looking out at that crowd, I could see that some of them would probably have been receptive. And, they started speaking to me as an individual and not at the line. And I thought, this is the opportunity that the first crack in the shield for us to actually get out there and try to have a dialogue. And, it's really incumbent upon the police to take that first step. And over the barricade, I went and the dialogue started. And what I can tell you, the contacts that I made that day with some of the people in the crowd, and I don't know if they're leaders in the movement, but they were definitely facilitators. They were collaborators. So we developed a rapport where I could talk to them. They began calling and texting and vice versa. And we started talking through our responses because, we start finding out that, that they're perceiving every little thing we do is an offensive gesture. And in our minds, it's merely defensive, trying to make sure that our cops are safe, our city's safe. So it was, I think it was that watershed moment. And I'm not saying that that helped put the riots down completely, because that's not true. But it did establish some relationships to help us move forward. And as we moved on into the following week, as we all know, it became much more peaceful. We were not forced to make arrests. So it definitely helped. It helped us to move forward to this point today where, there's still a lot of work to be done, but we're in a much better place than we were a week ago.
So the clip that's circulating is you with a young black female from the West Side. And the thing that struck me is that you gave her your cell phone number. Have you texted with her? Have you talked to her subsequently?
That one that was filmed with that dialogue, I have not heard from that young lady. Subsequently, there was another young lady that stopped me as soon as I was done speaking to her. And we did exchange numbers. And we have been communicating almost daily in some fashion.
What are those conversations like for you? Are you learning things from them?
Absolutely. I think, you know, this is a different movement. It's a young person's movement, and, you know, may not realize this, but I am getting up there in the years, and the gray hair is showing it. So it's trying to put ourselves, you know, looking at it from their perspective of, you know, 20-year-olds is a challenge regardless of what's going on, because there is a generational gap. So I am learning. You know, what I'm finding out from speaking with individuals is sometimes, you know, they perceive things about the Cincinnati Police Department, but it's just because we haven't done a very good job of educating. And I think the police are really, really good about doing. We're great about getting out in the community, but sometimes we're not really good about showcasing all the good that we do. And what I'm finding out from those conversations is a lot of the things that they want, a lot of the things that they think that we should be doing, we're already doing. We're just not doing a good enough job of making sure that the community is aware of all the different pieces that we've got moving.
You, this is your 30th year of the Cincinnati Police Department, and meaning, and you referenced obviously being with the department in the 2001. How have you been able to draw upon the experience in 2001 to now? And you've been assistant chief for, what, 4.5 years?
Yes.
So, if you could briefly say, what was your role in 2001? And then also, how have you drawn on that experience from then to now?
Absolutely. Back in 2001, I was a relief sergeant. So I was put in charge of a group of officers, and we were told to go out and save the city and preserve the peace. You know, it was nowhere near as coordinated as we are now. And I think, you know, that's a testament to the evolution of policing. But, you know, it was a night and day difference. And if we really want to say it, in regards to our strategies being very precise in our application, I think, you know, and not everybody's going to agree, but we were proactive when we needed to be proactive, and we were constantly evaluating our responses, our strategies, and when there was an opportunity to de-escalate, we de-escalated. One of the things that, you know, I told the cops in the roll call every day is that we are there to facilitate, and we are not there to agitate. That if something was going to go awry, it was not going to be because of the actions of the Cincinnati Police Department. And I think our officers held true to that.
How hard is it for you to see, you know, these officers that are part of your, you know, police family and that you are charged with keeping safe? How hard is it to see at the beginning when they were throwing like rocks and bottles and I heard urine. Like, how hard was it to see that happening to them? And what did you feel like when they were able to be so stoic and not respond?
Incredibly difficult challenge, because in the back of my mind every day is, you know, I know that there's a mission. It's to go out, it's to protect our community, it's to protect our citizens. And that includes those that are demonstrating. That includes those that are protesting. We have that obligation. And then we protect, you know, the property. But first and foremost, I've got to make sure that each and every officer that was in that roll call when we started is there for dismissal, and I'm sending them home to their family. So while all this is going on, it weighs greatly in your mind that, you know, the chief, myself, the other assistant chiefs have an obligation to make sure that our cops go home safe. And it's a little difficult because we have a lot of new officers. And a lot of them were not around 2001, and this was their first experience where the community really was not receptive to our community policing overtures and where we are. And I could see it in their eyes, and they needed direction, and we have to, you know, we have to give them direction, and we have to make sure that they're safe, you know. And I think it really hit home on Saturday night when we had Officer Warmoth shot, and just by the grace of God, that bullet struck his ballistic shield or his ballistic helmet. Otherwise, it would have struck him right in the forehead, and we probably would have had a dead officer in the middle of this. So we cannot forget about that we were under physical attack, and we're just grateful that you know, some luck played into it. We're grateful that the city administration had invested in a lot of this equipment for us in years past, and it saved our officer.
Covering City Hall, I will say, you know, over time it comes through law committee and it's like, it's always about the cost of equipment. Like, that's kind of the story that comes out. Like, can we afford it? Is it going to be in the budget? But this was a real life, you know, situation where that's why we did it. And like, that's not typically what we write about.
You know, we're very thankful for the leaders at City Hall and our electeds that have provided us the necessary equipment over the years. You know, it's the old mantra that, you know, you prepare for the worst and you hope for the best. But, you know, equipment does play a large part of this. And equipment's expensive, technology's expensive, and we're very grateful for them investing in the Cincinnati Police Department ahead of time, because it's real easy that, you know, we went 19 years without any major civil disturbance. So it's easy to get lulled in that mindset that we don't really need to buy this because it's not going to happen again. It won't happen here. And now we saw that that's not completely true. And I think, you know, I think that was one of the things that, you know, I won't say that I'm naive, but it did hurt a little bit, because we have always said that we have to work on our relationships with the community every single day, because when there is that next critical incident, it just takes one thing to be that tipping point. And, you know, we had thought that we were getting close to that, that if something bad went down, that the community knew that we were a new police department, that we were much more responsive, we were much more transparent, we were much more engaging. And I think what we saw is we're just not there yet. So we have a lot of work ahead of us to reengage the community, build those bridges, because I don't think any of us want to go through this again, Sherry.
What is the way to do that? Are there mechanisms in place that just kind of fell by the wayside because, you know, everybody gets busy and it's like, it's not the priority anymore? Or do you feel like we're going to have to do some new things and look around the country at best practices?
No, I mean, we've always been a community policing agency. We have dedicated NLU officers, neighborhood liaison officers, in each of the districts. That is their sole function, is to bridge the gaps between the police department and the community. And that is, you know, that's our tip of the spear. But we expect every Cincinnati police officer to be community oriented and engaged. And it's just those conversations on the street. But I think, you know, what I have seen from the last few days is we have to figure out a way to bridge that gap of, you know, that millennial generation, those 16 to 25 year olds. And, you know, we have programs for our youth. We're very good at dealing with our established citizenry that come to our community meetings, but that's an area that we're missing. And we can tell that we need to figure out how to broach that gap, because they're the ones that they're unhappy with what policing is in the 21st century. And I think there's some learning on both ends that we can do.
When it comes to you talking about, you know, those first, you know, 3 or 4 days there when things are being thrown at officers and everything in the book being yelled at them, how does an officer prepare, I guess, mentally even, to stand there and take so much, you know, heat and but just so, you know, so much verbal abuse? Is there something that officers go through to train for that very type of situation? Because I'm thinking, like, I get a few people saying some nasty things about me on Twitter, my blood gets boiling. But, you know, how can an officer stand there and, you know, for hours upon hours, you know, be able to take that and be stoic? And, you know, how do they prepare for that?
Well, it starts in an academy. You know, we teach professionalism, and you know, we realize that we're not going to be at the top of many people's fan lists sometimes. And, you know, one of the big things that we do when this is happening is the supervisors have an absolutely critical role to be constantly assessing their people. And you hit it right there. That, you know, there's a lot of people that are coming to peacefully protest. but there's a lot of them that come, and they have the intention of provoking a response from the police so that it gets caught, you know, by the media or whoever else, and it portrays the police in a bad light. And we tell them, do not allow them to push your buttons. Do not get provoked into a confrontation. Be the calm, cool professional that we know you are. And a lot of it comes down to the supervisors. We have to be constantly assessing our officers to make sure that, you know, they're withhandling, that they're handling the verbal abuse, that they're not going to overreact. And, you know, one of the things that we did on the line many times is these demonstrators and protesters would focus on a particular officer. And some of the things they were saying, yes, vile, crude, that any other time it would make the front page of the paper if someone used that type of language towards somebody. But when we see that, then we have an obligation to rotate that officer out of that position, put in someone else, and make sure that they don't provoke that response. And our supervisors did an absolutely fantastic job of recognizing it, managing it, and making sure that, like I said, that we did not instigate any type of unwanted action.
Can you talk a little bit about the idea that there were agitators, you know, in the crowd? I mean, the chief has talked about this at multiple press conferences. We didn't really see any arrests of them, which is not to say they were not there, and how you're able to tell that.
Well, you know, we don't want to get into too many things right now, but I think it's fair to say that when you observe individuals that are showing up and they're wearing three and four sets of clothing, they're extremely padded, they have their own gas mask, they have milk or some other you know, liquid to dissipate tear gas, dissipate OC spray, they're not there for peaceful protest. We know that they were there to provoke a response, and it is only a handful. I think the problem that we see is that tensions are high, emotions are high, and people that came to just peacefully protest and dissipate some of that anger, these folks can, you know, their actions encourage them to take steps that normally they would not do. So it does become a struggle to, you know, to identify those and address them appropriately. But they were definitely there. We have intelligence that we were there. You know, there are people on the other side of that line that may be there, and they don't always agree with everything that's occurring, and they do relay that to law enforcement. So, you know, our visual observations, our intelligence from the crowd, many different sources are telling us that there were definitely agitators in the crowd. And we saw that, you know, those first couple nights, they weren't, you know, there were individuals there that were not there to peacefully protest. They were there to attack the police, and they were there to cause property damage and chaos. And, you know, we're glad that we were able to address that quickly the first couple days and get us to a better place.
We did see, I mean, I think that was one of the biggest shocks, like Saturday morning, you know, by 11 o'clock, 11:30 at night, like I was watching things, and then, you know, I'm not the night reporter on Friday nights. I went to bed. I was like, okay, it seems like it's going to be peaceful. You know, we saw a lot of things with the death of Sam DePose, which was a UC policing case. And we did see a lot of protests, and they were all peaceful. And the idea that the looting and the breaking into the businesses, like after that 11:30 mark, when a lot of people went to bed, was a shock. Do you think that we'll see a lot of arrests for what happened in those first nights? We did see someone arrested in the Saks, looting of Saks Fifth Avenue downtown. But, you know, there were these smaller businesses were hit too. Do you think we'll see arrests?
You know, what I can tell you is that we're going to do our best to review the video that's out there to follow up on those offenses and hold people accountable where we can. You know, in the middle of that, and I think we all saw what it was, it's hard to follow up with arrests where we're just trying to prevent the looting and the rioting. And, you know, we regrouped on Saturday and came back with a larger contingent of officers to make those necessary arrests. But as we go forward, I would say that if you were engaged in felony activity down there, there's cameras everywhere, as we know. And there is a good chance that you will be held accountable down the road. So, yes.
Great.
Sherry, I don't have any other questions. I have
one more question. Can you talk about, I'm not going to ask you to weigh in on a very political issue at the moment, whether the curfew charges should be dropped or not, but can you talk about the curfew charges as how the police officers use that as a tool? And if you'd like to weigh in on what you think, that's great. But I think we're going to leave that to the chief.
Yes, we'll leave that to the chief and some of those that are in a better position to speak to that. But I would say, you know, the curfew was a tool. It was a tool that we know was very effective in allowing us to get through, you know, a violent weekend. And I, you know, the intelligence that we had is that those cities that were enforcing a curfew and they were enforcing it during those early daylight hours were the ones that were being successful in preventing looting and rioting. And I think that's true. When you look at those cities, such as Cincinnati, that aggressively enforced the curfew for those first couple of days, they were able to mitigate the damage. Those that weren't able to use that as a tool, you know, the rioting and the destruction and the violent protests went on much longer. So it was a constant assessment. We used it as a tool those first couple of days. And then, as you can see, once it was effective and allowing us to reclaim some ground out on the street, very few arrests, if any. So it was a tool, it was effective, and hopefully we don't have to ever place the citizens of Cincinnati under a curfew again.
Assistant Chief Newdigate, this is I really appreciate you joining us today. Great respect for the work you do, and thanks for serving the community, and all the best things move forward here.
I appreciate it. Thanks for having me on. Thanks for letting us talk about it. And, there's a lot more dialogue that we need to have, and we appreciate the Inquirer being a conduit for between the police department and the community.
Thank you.
Thank you. Have a good day.
You too. Thanks a lot. Thanks again to Assistant Chief Paul Newdigate. Sherry, that was some great insight there from him.
You know, it really was, and that was such a good conversation, because normally when I have to interview him, or really any of us do, right, it's some pointed crime that we're talking about, like this happened or that happened, and we're not really like talking about the bigger issues. So I enjoyed talking about that and the idea of how the city is going to go forward. I do want to encourage, we always talk about our own Twitter accounts. I want to encourage people to follow his Twitter account, because we actually get news from it. And he posts about the good works that the officers do, you know, what, you know, drug bust there was, or the guns that have been recovered, and his Twitter account, it's an interesting one. So I want to encourage people to follow him on Twitter.
Good stuff. We call this the fun segment of the show.
And it's been suffering. It's been suffering, Jason. It's a struggle.
I know. It's so much stuff going on in the world right now, and it's been, I don't know, hard to have some fun or relax or, you know, just chill out. But hey, summer is here, and things are opening back up. The zoo's open back up. Kings Island's coming back. Pools are opening back up. What are your plans coming up here, Sherry?
Well, I keep saying I'm not going to work 12 hours every single day, but we'll see when that actually happens. But it does finally feel like summer. You know, we are still working from home. The office is closed. I miss everyone so much. But, you know, Jack was screaming at the front door yesterday, I want to come in. And I was like, well, come in. Stairs from the home office, but it turns out he was soaking wet from a water balloon fight. And I was like, this is so summer.
Yeah.
He needed a towel. And so I am happy to see like the signs of summer coming back and playing outside. And I, you know, 7 of the city pools are open now. They're taking reservations. It's very different than other years. But that's good to see too, because they're such a critical part of like summers in Cincinnati. So it's starting to feel like summer again.
Of course, the Reds aren't here, and I'm not optimistic that we will have Reds baseball this year. But we're going to have FC Cincinnati soccer, not here in the city, But they're gonna ramp up and play. All in Major League Soccer is going to play in Orlando.
It is. I mean, they really made this happen. Other sports, you know, their television rights are much more lucrative than Major League Soccer at this point. And yet here we see Major League Soccer, you know, just this really, here's what it's going to look like and all of the details. And so I think that they might find some new fans this way, even though it's disappointing, like this was going to be the last year for FC Cincinnati at Nippert. Mm-hmm. You know, with a new coach and, you know, a lot of new players this year. And I think there was so much excitement to have that happen as the transition comes to the new stadium in the West End. But it's something. It's happening.
Well, yeah. And people, I think people are going to watch soccer on TV, American soccer, Major League Soccer, like they've never watched it before. And obviously there won't be any fans there in Orlando. But the big thing is going to be that it's going to be a TV thing, and fans will be able to watch. Speaking of the stadium, Sherry, you toured that, right? Not too long ago.
Mostly just from the outside. I've been writing a whole bunch about what the inside's going to look like. That's the latest. You know, we can see the outside. It's really coming out of the ground. The canopy pieces are even being built at this point. But I've been writing a lot about what that outside is going to look like with the clubs, and, you know, these new stadiums are just light years ahead of, I can just remember like coming here, like as the Red Stadium was being built and we were on the heels of the Bengal Stadium. And we hear so much, right, about the Bengal Stadium and compared to other stadiums, just this whole stadium experience is a whole new ball game, I suppose. And with this club, the West End Stadium is going to have a beer hall in it with, you know, the parks, the Cincinnati's history. Fans expect a lot more now, and we're seeing that come in the stadium. And I also do not think that we have heard the last of the idea that the Bengal Stadium is going to need a lot of upgrades too, especially when you see what this West End Stadium is going to look like.
Let's keep it positive.
Some people would say that is positive.
Oh, yeah, they would. No, it's I tell you, if you haven't been downtown or, you know, the urban core lately at the West End over the Rhine there, the stadium is coming together, and it's amazing to see how big it is. You know, I remember covering games when I was a sports writer at Stargell Stadium there at Taft High School, and yeah, regular size high school football stadium, and then to think now this massive soccer stadium can fit into that area. It's just, and obviously they've taken other areas around that, but it's just, it's hard to envision until you go down there and actually see it.
No, absolutely. I was down there on a walk. It's fun to walk around downtown and, like, you know, see how it's changing and becoming more vibrant. And, you know, I've been, you know, seeing some of these daytime protests, and you do see how large it is. It's just a complete shadow over the Cincinnati Ballet. And I wrote so much about the idea of whether the ballet should stay in its location, which had a lease on that land that the team had bought, or it's going to have a new home in Walnut Hills. And you can see that it's really sitting in the shadow of that stadium. And so its new home is going to be, I think, something special for them.
Yeah, that's great. Summer, you know, different. It's going to be a different summer, but certainly some of the things that we love and that are very much the fabric of summer in Cincinnati are coming back in some form or fashion. And
Zoo, Kings Island Aquarium, they're coming, you know, pretty brisk here. 1, 2, 3.
You'll be happy to know that I've also found a new place to work, as I've shared on this podcast and with my coworkers many times. I cannot work at home with two young kids, and it's just insane. Two sons who have been at each other's throats for 3 months. It has calmed down the last 3 weeks, which has been great. But I finally have found a place to work, and Panera is one of those few kind of coffee restaurant types of places where, you know, those places where you can kind of work has opened up their dining rooms. So if anyone's worried about me, don't worry about me. I got a place to work. I say tongue in cheek.
All right. Well,
cool.
It's going to be a week.
Hey, we've gotten some nice emails, some suggestions. Emails, keep emailing us. jwilliams@inquirer.com, scoolidge@inquirer.com. Hit us up on Twitter at Sharon Coolidge and at jwilliamscincy with a Y. And we're back rolling again. It's great to be back, Sherry. It's so weird. Like, we haven't seen each other in person since March. But obviously we talk every day and
every day
podcast. So it's great. It's great to be here on the podcast again. And thanks to our producer, Silent Phil, and we will catch you next week.